Today, the second wave risks. The DFA Daily to the 11th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Jerome Powell's press conference to accompany the announcement of low rates stretching out as far as the eye can see included a question on whether he was worried that a potential asset price bubble was forming thanks to the low rates and asset purchases. The Fed's economic estimates show they expect inflation below the 1% lower bound of their target for this year, and they don't expect the unemployment rate to return to its pre-COVID low, even by the end of 2022. But part of his response shows that Powell is happy to go down into history as a bubble maker, not a bubble breaker. He said, "Our principal focus is on the state of the economy and on the labour market and on inflation. Now, inflation, of course, is low, and we think it's very likely to remain low for some time below our target. Really, it's about getting the labour market back and getting it in shape. That's been our major focus. I would say if we were to hold back because we would never do this, but the idea that just the concept that we would hold back because we think asset prices are too high. Others may not think so, but we just decided that that's the case. What would happen to those people? What would happen to the people that we're actually legally supposed to be serving? We're supposed to be pursuing maximum employment and stable prices, and that's what we're pursuing." And he also spoke of his concern for financial stability and extolled the strength of the banking system while reiterating that the Fed would focus on its real economy goals. With an economy now largely dependent on high asset prices and the ability of borrowers to roll over huge amounts of leverage, he was effectively disavowing any interest in acting proactively to puncture bubbles when they emerged. Given the weak US economy and the global economy, of course, and with an election only 5 months away, he's decided to take the risk of going down in history as another great bubble blower. Of course, this sets up a puzzle for investors. Assuming the asset bubble expands further, there is money to be made in the bubble, providing you get out before it bursts. And acting to take advantage helps to ensure that it inflates at a time when the future path of COVID and its economic impacts are highly uncertain. And to that end, the OECD released new data overnight and talked about, after the lockdown, a tightrope walk ahead to recovery. They said as long as no vaccine or treatment is widely available, policymakers around the world will continue to walk on a tightrope. Physical distancing and testing, tracking, tracing and isolation, or TTTI, will be the main instruments to fight the spread of the virus. TTTI is indispensable for economic and social activities to resume, but those sectors affected by border closures and those requiring close personal contact, such as tourism, travel, entertainment, restaurants and accommodation, will not resume as before. TTTI may not even be enough to prevent a second outbreak of the virus. Faced with this extraordinary uncertainty, any previous recession over the last 100 years outside wartime, with dire and long-lasting consequences for people, firms and governments, the pandemic has accelerated the shift from great integration to great fragmentation, they said. Additional trade and investment restrictions have sprung up, and many borders are closed across large regions and will likely remain so, at least in parts, as long as sizable virus outbreaks continue. Economies are diverging depending on when and to what extent they were hit by the virus, the preparedness of their healthcare system, their sectoral specialization, and their fiscal capacity to address the shock. Emerging market economies have also been shaken by the crisis, and commodity prices have plummeted. Large capital outflows, plummeting remittances, weaker healthcare systems, and a large share of informal workers have threatened their health, economic, and social resilience. Everywhere, The lockdown has also exacerbated inequality across workers, with those able to telework generally highly qualified, while the least qualified and youth are often on the front line, unable to work or laid off, with the effects further compounded by unequal access to social protection. Private debt levels are uncomfortably high in some countries, and business failure and bankruptcy risks loom large. Extraordinary policies will be required to walk the tightrope towards recovery, they said. Even if growth does surge in some sectors, overall activity will remain muted for a while. Governments can provide the safety nets that allow people and firms to adjust, but cannot uphold private sector activity, employment and wages for a prolonged period. Capital and workers from impaired sectors and businesses will have to move towards expanding ones. And such transitions are difficult and rarely happen fast enough to prevent the number of failing firms from rising and a sustained period of unemployment. Governments will need to adapt support and accompany the transition, allowing fast restructuring processes for firms with no stigma for entrepreneurs, providing income for workers in between jobs, training for those laid off, and transitioning to new jobs and social protection for the most vulnerable. We have previously, they say, called for a rise in public investment in digital and green technologies to promote long-term sustainable growth and lift demand in the short term. This is even more urgent today, with economies having been hit so hard. Governments must seize this opportunity to engineer a fairer and more sustainable economy, making competition and regulation smarter, modernizing government taxes, spending, and social protection. Prosperity, they say, comes from dialogue and cooperation. This holds true at the national and at the global level. And turning to specific countries, the OECD said that New Zealand's swift and decisive response against COVID-19 successfully contained the virus outbreak, saving lives and allowing the economy to reopen faster. However, confinement brought a number of sectors to a sudden stop in the second quarter. Assuming that there are no further virus outbreaks, the single hit scenario, GDP is projected to shrink by nearly 9% in 2020 and only return to the pre-crisis level by the end of 2021. Should there be a second global wave of infections in the fourth quarter of 2020, the double hit scenario, GDP is projected to shrink by 10% in 2020 and to remain 3.5% below the pre-crisis level by the end of 2021. In the first half of April, New Zealanders cut back visits to retailers and recreational areas more than in any other OECD country with available data. The tourism sector, which accounted for about 10% of GDP and 20% of exports in 2019, was particularly hard hit as both international and domestic demand evaporated. Both exports and imports have fallen sharply, and by late April, employers were receiving wage subsidies for 1.7 million workers, two-thirds of private sector employment, to preserve their jobs. Business confidence has plummeted to record lows, although it started to recover in May. Massive fiscal and monetary supports are in place. The policy response to COVID-19 has been timely, substantial, and well-coordinated, they said. The fiscal response package amounted to 12.1 billion New Zealand dollars, or 4% of GDP, and that was announced on the 17th of March. And it was followed up by a 50 billion New Zealand dollar fund announced in the May 2020 budget, of which about $30 billion has already been allocated. Major support measures include a large wage subsidy scheme, which was extended from June to September in a more targeted form, a loan guarantee scheme for SMEs, under which the government bears 80% of the credit risk, tax deferrals and reliefs, increased social benefits, as well as increased support for the healthcare and aviation sectors. A six-month interest and principal payment deferral scheme was also established by banks for borrowers having debt servicing difficulties. Legislation providing insolvency relief for companies and other entities has been passed, and these measures are helping to preserve jobs and prevent viable firms from going bankrupt. Meanwhile, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand cut the policy rate by 75 basis points to 0.25%, delayed implementation of planned increases in bank capital adequacy requirements, and began a large-scale asset purchase program of central and local government bonds amounting to up to 60 billion New Zealand dollars, which is 20% of annual GDP, to reduce long-term interest rates. The recovery will be gradual and vulnerable to the effects of new waves of infection. The economy has started to recover, but even in the absence of further virus outbreaks, the single hit scenario will only regain the pre-crisis level of output by the end of 2021, owing to low activity in sectors recovering from strict distancing requirements. A surge in unemployment following the scaling back and subsequent termination of the wage subsidy scheme, together with a large reduction in net inward migration and a loss in housing wealth, will hold back private consumption, and business investment will remain subdued, reflecting weak business confidence and low capacity utilization. Goods exports will increase on the back of strong global demand for food, but tourism exports will be slow to recover because the border is likely to remain closed to foreign visitors at least to early 2021. In the event of a second global wave of infections, the double hit scenarios, the economy will contract again and the unemployment rate will reach 10% in late 2020. The border will remain closed longer, further delaying the recovery of tourism exports and migration. In these circumstances, the government is assumed to increase fiscal stimulus by 2.5% of GDP. In both scenarios, slower recovery of the world economy, particularly in China, New Zealand's largest export market, would further delay the recovery. On the other hand, tourism and travel would get a substantial boost if travel between Australia and New Zealand is allowed before the more general opening of the border. And now turning to Australia, if a second outbreak of the virus occurred here, growth would fall by 6.3% this year and global growth would fall by 7.6%, according to the OECD report, which calls for further stimulus, including extending JobKeeper, despite the fact that some economists question whether there's been too much stimulus already. Despite Australia hitting its first recession in 29 years, the report says Australia's economy has been relatively spared so far from the COVID-19 outbreak. Macroeconomic policy support, including JobKeeper, had limited the economic damage, it said. The report urges the Morrison government to introduce further policy measures to support households and businesses, including extending income support payments such as the $70 billion JobKeeper wage subsidy, and building social housing. While shutdowns and social distancing restrictions are being eased, the report warned that a possible second wave of COVID-19 infections would detract from growth more sharply. It said, should widespread contagion resume with a return to lockdown, confidence would suffer and cash flow would be strained. The report also said that in that double hit scenario, gross domestic product would fall by 6.3% in 2020. Even in the absence of a second outbreak, GDP could fall by 5% in 2020. Reduced consumer demand and uncertainty weighing on business investment could lengthen the time it takes to recover. These headwinds are larger in the double hit scenario. A second wave of infections due to prolonged financial stress, together with greater uncertainty, the report warned. A key risk to the outlook is that high household indebtedness, resulting in debt servicing problems, potentially amplified by a housing market downturn and derails the recovery, they said. It said in the best case scenario, Australia's unemployment rate would hit 7.4% this year and 7.6% next year. And in the double hit scenario, it would hit 7.6% this year and 8.8% next year. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg said the outlook for Australia was the third best among 36 OECD members. There is still a long way to go in recovering from this once-in-a-100-year global pandemic, but we're headed in the right direction and we will continue to do all that is necessary to ensure Australia bounces back stronger on the other side of the crisis, he said. The OECD suggests that if a second outbreak occurs, triggering a return to lockdowns, world economic output is forecast to plummet 7.6% this year before climbing back 2.8% in 2021. At its peak, unemployment in the OECD economies will be more than double the rate prior to the outbreaks, with little recovery in jobs next year. In many advanced economies, the equivalent of 5 years or more of per capita real income growth would be lost by 2021. And if a second wave of infection is avoided, global economic activity is expected to fall by 6% in 2020, and OECD unemployment will climb to 9.2%. The economic impact of strict and lengthy lockdowns will be particularly harsh for some countries. Euro area GDP is expected to plunge by 11.5% this year if a second wave breaks out, and by more than 9% even if a second hit is avoided. GDP in the United States will take a hit of 8.5% and 7.3% respectively. And the report said governments and monetary authorities had reacted remarkably quickly to the crisis, reducing the spread of the virus and preventing an even larger economic and financial collapse. In Australia, between March and May, federal and state governments announced direct fiscal support amounting to over 8% of 2020 GDP, and the JobKeeper wage subsidy was equivalent to over 3.5% of GDP. But the OECD said Australian authorities should be considering further stimulus after September. Extraordinary policies will be needed to walk the tightrope towards recovery, OECD chief economist Lawrence Boone said. Higher public debt cannot be avoided, but debt finance spending should be well targeted to support the most vulnerable. While the JobKeeper wage subsidy was helping keep official unemployment figures low, job losses had been wide and especially harsh in hospitality and entertainment. In particular, some income support measures may need to be extended beyond their September expiry date, the report said. It suggested that the scarring effect of unemployment, especially for younger workers, be alleviated through education and training, and that firms continue to be supported with longer loan guarantees. The report also suggested more government investment in social and physical infrastructure. The authorities should also ensure that the social safety net is adequate and consider further investment in energy efficient improvements and social housing, it said. But then again, ANZ chief economist Richard Yesker said it is possible that policymakers had gone too far with the stimulus measures. The risk is rising that policymakers have delivered an easing that presupposes more severe outcomes than the pandemic has caused in most economies to this point, he said in a research note. During the global financial crisis, policymakers waited for economic and financial sector weakness to unfold before they moved. This time around, policymakers had moved ahead of the data, and easing had been widespread globally, including in emerging markets. The fiscal stimulus is about triple that of the global financial crisis, according to the IMF. As well, because interest rates in many economies were very low before this crisis began, central banks and governments had stepped up with direct lending schemes. These can negate any hesitancy on the part of commercial banks to lend in an environment where they might become more cautious about risking capital. While some sectors, including airline travel, international tourism, international education, the arts, some restaurants and retail, were in trouble, these sectors tend to be large employers, often for women or young people, and at less than full-time hours. Investment in these sectors is likely to be correspondingly weak, he warned, and he said the pandemic has also tended to impact ethnic minorities and migrants disproportionately. And now let's look at the property sector. The AFR reported that new home listings blew out in April, with Sydney and Melbourne adding more than 20% new stock on the market in just 1 month, as the virus lockdown deepened, the latest Domain data shows. In Sydney, a total of 17,289 houses hit the market, up 25.2% from March. An additional 8,708 units were put up for sale, lifting the apartment stock on the market by 18.4%, the listings group state of the market report shows. News listings surged more than 20% in Sydney and Melbourne during April, Domain said. In Melbourne, 24,003 houses entered the market, boosting existing stock by 20.6% over the month, while unit stock expanded by 20.6% as well. Domain is majority owned, of course, by Nine, publisher of the Australian Financial Review, so it's all connected. Stock on the market has been rising even as signs grow that the boost from the lifting of restrictions may have run at its peak. Last weekend's auction clearance rates were anemic. CoreLogic figures on Thursday confirmed the week's clearance rate at 56.2%, putting the rate below the 60% figure that often indicates rising prices. New listings in Hobart surged 53.1% for houses and 63.1% 5.4% for units, the highest increase across capital cities. A slightly smaller but still substantial increase in house listings was recorded in Brisbane. Housing stock rose by 10.2%, but unit listings fell by 5%. Canberra notched up a 27.1% rise in household stock, while unit listings grew by 2.4%. Despite a spike in new listings, sales volumes remained weak during April. Only Sydney and Canberra recorded a rise in house sales, with 1.4% and 2.7% gains respectively. The rest of the capitals recorded sharp declines. Sales volumes dropped by 1.4% in Melbourne, Brisbane fell by 17.9% and Perth by 20.6%. With restrictions on open inspections and auctions being gradually lifted, vendor sentiment is starting to turn. And now this from the Property Observer. In an article titled "Housing Boom Propelled Inequality, But Coronavirus Bust Will Skyrocket It," by Ian Weisel, a senior lecturer in urban geography at the University of Melbourne, Liz Ralston, an urban statistician at the Centre for Urban Transitions, Swinburne University of Technology, and Wendy Stone, Associate Professor at the Centre for Urban Transitions and the Director of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute at the Swinburne Institute of Technology. They said, a housing boom that lasted from the mid-1980s with only minor interruptions has added to rising income inequality in Australia. Yet an impending housing market bust, triggered by the coronavirus pandemic and the resulting spike in unemployment, will not restore greater equality. On the contrary, recent history shows housing busts can worsen inequality. Those who benefit most from a boom are not those who pay the price when it busts, and those harmed by the boom often become even more vulnerable during the bust. Their analysis highlights the risks for people who bought their first home at the peak of the boom. They estimate 24,000 households are at very high risk because they took out large loans that might soon exceed their home value and also work in sectors with high job losses. And then another 135,200 are at high risk and 121,000 are at moderate risk. Coronavirus has set up a housing bust. Experts have long cited an upsurge in unemployment as the main threat to house price growth. The risk became reality with the coronavirus pandemic. Over the 7 weeks from mid-March to early May, jobs fell by 7.3%. Unless unemployment rapidly recovers, the housing market is facing a major downturn. In one worst-case scenario released by the Commonwealth Bank, house prices could fall by up to 32% over the next 2 years. Recent first-time buyers are most vulnerable. Households that can hold on to their homes and weather the storm until the market recovers are not substantially harmed. Established owners who bought their homes before or early in the boom years have enjoyed the largest increases in their capital values and the largest reductions in their debt. This puts them in a position of relative resilience to a housing market bust. In contrast, evidence from the 2008 housing crisis in the United States shows which households are most at risk. Those were households that bought their first home with no deposit, or a very low one, in the period leading up to the 2008 crash. The crash left those households underwater, trapped with an asset worth less than their mortgage debt. Many defaulted on their mortgages, fueling the housing market's downward spiral. The Australian housing market and financial institutions differ from those in the United States in 2008 in fundamental ways. Still, Australian households that bought their homes at the peak of the boom and have now lost their jobs in the coronavirus pandemic are facing the highest risk. These include 24,000 recent first-time buyers, that's 2014-15 and 2017-18, buyers who borrowed over 80% of the value of their home and were employed in industries where jobs have now collapsed. Another 135,200 recent first home buyers with high loan-to-value ratios are also at risk of going underwater, with homes worth less than their debt. And many of them are also in precarious employment, irrespective of the pandemic. And by the way, those figures do not include first home buyers in 2018-19, for which data is not yet available. Renters' relief could be short-lived because many private renters hope a housing downturn will translate into lower rents and perhaps give them a chance to buy their first home in a more affordable market. However, this is not always the case in a downturn. In the US from 2007 to 2009, despite declining house prices, rental affordability stress has only increased. In Australia, the sudden decline in international students and short-term rentals has increased long-term rental vacancies in some areas. Reports suggest rents are going down, especially at the upper end of some rental markets. However, in the longer run, the slowdown in housing construction will create supply shortages, leaving rental vacancies low and rents high. Many landlords, mostly mum and dad investors, have taken large loans to finance their property investment. They will need to keep rents high to hold on to their investment properties. And lower house prices will enable some households to become homeowners for the first time after being locked out of the market during the boom years. These households could benefit from a coronavirus housing bust if the market then recovers. Even so, their gains will do little to change the overall trend of rising inequality made worse by the housing downturn. And they concluded, we need to flatten out booms and busts. Improved housing affordability is necessary to reduce social and economic inequality. A housing downturn will reduce house prices, but this downturn, when coupled with rising unemployment, will not deliver greater equality, especially if it's followed by yet another boom. And finally, they conclude that Australia has flattened the curve of COVID-19 infections. To be successful in reducing inequality, we need to flatten the curve of both booms and busts in the housing market cycle. And only a thorough overhaul of national housing policy will achieve that. And also, according to the AFR, roughly one third of newly rented properties are now discounting to win tenants, as a discounting war is in full swing in the rental market, as landlords try to fill empty properties or keep existing tenants, with the proportion of properties with discounts surging since the emergence of COVID-19. Between February and May, the proportion of listings with rents discounted increased across all the capital cities except Darwin, with inner city landlords feeling the most heat. One or more reasons why more property investors are looking to quit before things get worse. And here's another from the ACCC. The federal court has ordered Quantum Housing Group to pay $700,000 in penalties for making false or misleading representations relating to the National Rental Affordability Scheme, the NRAS. Between February 2017 and July 2018, Quantum sent a series of misleading letters and emails to at least 450 investors who had rental dwellings participating in the NRAS scheme, and pressurised them to terminate their arrangements with their existing property managers and instead use property managers approved or recommended by Quantum. Quantum failed to tell investors that it had commercial links with the property managers it recommended. And Quantum also told investors that their existing property manager had not properly managed their property's compliance with the NRAS when this was not true. This conduct was blatant, planned, and deliberate in an effort to trick investors into switching from their preferred property managers, ACCC Chair Rod Sims said. Quantum admitted that it falsely represented that property managers must meet accredited guidelines issued by Quantum and that investors who failed to appoint an approved property manager were in default of their agreement with Quantum and risked losing their NRAS incentives. And the court also ordered Quantum's director, Cheryl Howe, to pay $50,000 in penalties for being knowingly concerned in Quantum's breaches of the Australian consumer law. Ms. Howe was also disqualified from managing a corporation for 3 years, and the penalties ordered against Quantum and Ms. Howe serve as a warning that making false or misleading statements will result in serious consequences, not just for the company involved, but also any executive or employee found to be knowingly concerned in the conduct, Mr. Sims said. And finally, the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of Consumer Sentiment rebounded 16.4% to 88.1 in May,
from the extremely weak 75.6 read in April. Remarkably, consumer confidence is now back around pre-COVID levels, having recovered all of the extreme 20% drop from when the pandemic exploded in March and April. Confidence has clearly been buoyed by Australia's continued success in bringing the virus under control, which has in turn allowed for a further easing in social restrictions over the last month. The index is now only 2% below the average in the preceding September to February period, but note that sentiment was already on the weak side prior to the COVID shock, with the index through this earlier period showing a persistent excess of pessimists over optimists. With the unemployment rate set to remain elevated, extensive restrictions staying in place, and the economy facing permanent structural change, it would be surprising if the recent upward momentum continues and is able to sustain a stable level of confidence, which is above that of the previous period. And they commented that they'd seen more even confidence levels in the major states as restrictions began to be eased extensively across the country. Victoria lagged New South Wales in May with an 8.4% lift compared to 23%. However, in June, confidence in Victoria has jumped by 11.7% to 94.9, compared to 4.8 in New South Wales to 95.5. Overall confidence is now at a comparable level across both states. While the monthly gains are impressive, the index is still relatively weak by historical standards, in pessimistic territory overall and down 7% from a year ago. The general picture is of contained, intense pressure on family finances and concern about the near-term outlook for the economy, but with firming optimism around prospects for finance in the year ahead and the economy's medium-term outlook. The contrast between the medium-term outlook in this recession and the last recession in the early 1990s is important because this component of the index is around 50% higher than the average over a long 4 years in that earlier period. Respondents are confident that they can see eventually better times ahead, whereas in the early 1990s there was a pervasive mood of despair for years. All component indexes recorded gains in June, but the largest improvements were around views on the economic outlook and the time to buy a major item. Consumer concerns around the economy are definitely easing. The economy next 12 months subindex is up another 8.4%, and the economy next 5 years subindex is up 6.4%. But while consumers remain concerned about the economy's near-term prospects and the news around employment, they are much less concerned about the prospect of a further rise in unemployment. The Westpac Melbourne Institute Unemployment Expectations Index fell a further 7% in June, following a 13.4% drop in May, unwinding all of the 17.4% jump over March and April. The impressive turnaround means the index is now at 127, slightly below its long-run average of 130. And note that this is consistent with a stabilisation in unemployment around current levels over the next year, rather than a decline back to pre-COVID levels. Nevertheless, the easing in job loss fears is a key factor that will tend to see those still with jobs less restrained with their spending decisions. The complication around this reading, however, is those respondents whose employers are receiving JobKeeper payments and how that makes them feel about their job security. Sentiment around housing showed a modest improvement in June. Assessments around time to buy consolidating on previous gains and price expectations showing a bit of a lift, albeit to still very weak levels. The time to buy a dwelling index dipped 0.5% but held on most of May's strong rebound following the collapse in this index in April. At 107.6, the index continues to hold in positive territory, but it is still well below 2019's average level of 118, a pattern evident across all of the major states. To date, house prices have held up surprisingly well, albeit on extremely low turnover. Resilient reads on the time to buy a dwelling are encouraging, but the survey continues to point to a sharp deterioration in the outlook for prices compared to the last few months. Consumer expectations for house prices posted a solid gain, with the Westpac Melbourne Institute House Price Expectations Index lifting 10.5%. But that said, at 80.6, the index is still in deeply pessimistic territory, 43% below the optimistic readings immediately prior to the COVID-19 lockdown. Again, pessimism extends across all the major states, although it is somewhat more entrenched in Victoria at 75.3 than in New South Wales at 84.2. Responses to additional questions on the wisest place for savings shows risk aversion has lifted since March. Safe options are still in favour, two-thirds of consumers nominating deposits, superannuation or pay down debt as the best place for savings, compared to 63% in December. The proportion favouring real estate dropped back to 9% from 13% in March, matching the record low set this time last year. With price expectations negative, investors look likely to stay away from Australia's housing market near term. And unusually, more respondents nominated shares at 11.4% than real estate as preferred investment options. So if you put all that together, I think we can conclude that the housing sector will continue to see falls ahead with more listings, low sales and low levels of confidence. But the broader question, of course, is what's going to happen with the virus? Will it come back for a wave two? If it does, this would have a significantly negative impact on our economy. And even without a second wave, the economy will be weaker next year than last year. So once again, this is more evidence that we are not going to see a V-shaped recovery. We may see a U-shaped recovery if we're lucky, but I think there are many moving parts and many risks. And once again, I think the OECD is calling it about right in terms of the potential scenarios. It's quite close to our own modelling. And remember, on that basis, we are still predicting, as a central case, that property prices will fall ahead. And next, I just want to remind you that our next live stream event is on the 16th of June 2020, next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time. And in that show, we'll be updating our finance and property scenarios and also taking questions live via the YouTube chat or ahead of time if you want to send questions through via the DFA blog. With so much going on, I think it'll be very interesting to see how the scenarios are morphing. Are we going to see a greater probability of price falls or price rises? And I will also have my postcode database online, so we can also discuss mortgage stress at a postcode level as well. So mark your diaries, and I'll look forward to seeing you then. And just before I go, if I may, a quick reminder to say that if you haven't subscribed to our Walk the World channel, then you're missing out, because we post most days. And if you have already subscribed, then also ring the bell, because then you'll get alerts each time we post. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching. And I'll see you again next time.